There are 282 mountains over 3,000 feet in elevation in Scotland, and in the spring of 2023, Jamie Arons set a new record for not only climbing them, but for travelling self-propelled between them. That means using bikes, kayaks, and of course, running. The mountains are called Munros, after Sir Hugh Munro, who first classified them in 1891, and their number has changed over the years as surveying techniques changed. A complete round is a challenge lasting years for most hill walkers, but Jamie did them in 31 days, 10 hours, and 27 minutes. She beat the previous record by 12 hours. That was set in 2020 by my friend Donnie Campbell. And after you've listened to Jamie's story, you can hear about Donnie's round in episode 35. In this episode, Jamie talks about how she did it, the sleep deprivation, choosing to camp rather than sleep in a camper van, and devising a much shorter route with less elevation gain and less cycling than Donnie's, plus how her background as a swimmer helped in this challenge. I had to wonder whether, after something as tough as that, she's recovered yet.
It's funny, I was saying to a friend a week or two ago that at the time, I guess I didn't feel greatly like I had anything to recover from. And I meant that somewhat facetiously, but also a little bit seriously, in that I expected it to be more of a run than it turned out to be, particularly at the end, in that I had sort of been throughout the first 3 weeks, especially, I was incredibly risk averse. I was being very cautious with how much I pushed the pace, how much I pushed kind of the physical toll I was putting on my body in terms of running. So it was, you know, I ran some, but it was largely just a really long walk with the intention that I was going to push the pace and try and run a bit more sort of in the last week, last 4 to 5 days. And unfortunately, I ended up with an incredibly sore foot, which had other ideas and definitely meant there was no running to be had. So while I thought that I was going to be quite pacey at the end, I was anything but. So I had some sleep deprivation to recover from, and the injury to my foot needed to resolve itself. But yeah, in general, my legs, certainly, which is what I expected, were going to be trashed, felt absolutely fine, which was great.
Well, that's actually surprising, isn't it? Was it a surprise to you as well, the interest that there was in you getting this record?
It was, I think. So I didn't have a phone switched on throughout the month. So I was vaguely aware, as friends were coming to join me on the hill, that there were dot watchers out there and that the number of dot watchers seemingly was increasing as I got closer to my final summit, which was incredibly motivating, if not also somewhat overwhelming, to know that there were people with their eye on whether or not I crossed the proverbial finish. I had an incredible help from one woman in particular, Nick Crossley, who had designed my website and did a ton of social media behind the scenes while I was out. So she was definitely helping to gather momentum for me and for the fundraising that we did and for the kind of community spirit we were attempting to build. And I think that did just have that snowball effect, that the more people who were dot watching, the more people who were aware of the fundraising, the more people who were aware that I was close to breaking the record, told other people who told other people. And, you know, like all these things, particularly with social media now, that did kind of grow into a far greater audience than I certainly ever expected.
And how significant was it that it was the record? It wasn't the women's record. It was the overall record that you took.
I think that certainly was something that captivated public attention, absolutely. I think for me, you know, when I set off, it was to go as quickly as I could go. And I knew that if all the stars aligned, that could have been the overall record. I knew that the women's record for a continuous self-propelled Munro round was far more time, actually, than I had time off work. So I knew that if I finished, I would have a new women's record. I knew that something would have needed to go quite catastrophically wrong, really, for me to be kind of delayed. And again, I would have needed to be back at work before the women's record sort of deadline. So yeah, to a great extent, for the first week or two, my focus was on kind of maintaining a pace, maintaining continuous movement as much as I could. And then certainly, you know, as it became as I became more aware that I did have the chance to break the overall record, that was certainly incredibly motivating. And certainly, I think, captured audiences as well who wanted to see. I suppose it I'm sure for many people reflects what I feel myself, which is that I'm certainly not a fast runner. I'm certainly not faster than previous record holder Donnie Campbell. But there was something there that was far more than just about the running or just about the cycling. It was so many variables that I was very fortunate came together for me for the record.
I'd like to get into the detail of some of that a little later, but it did surprise me to learn that actually your first competitive sport was swimming, which you did in California. How far did you go with your swimming? How competitive were you?
I was quite competitive growing up and through my teenage years, so through high school. I don't know how the sort of levels of competition in California would compare to here. I certainly, you know, I wasn't breaking state records or anything by any stretch of the imagination, but I had my aspirations. Probably when I was in my very, very early teens, I probably had thoughts that, getting to what we call junior nationals or senior nationals would have been, so that's kind of pre-Olympic kind of level. But it was about kind of high school competitions and competing for my high school at a fairly high level. And that, you know, included the 4:30 a.m. wake ups and the hour and a half practice before school and the 2 to 3 hours of practice after school and the weights and the, the chauffeuring from my mom in particular. Probably again, quite a team effort for an individual sport to get me as competitive as I was able to be.
And then how did that morph into running? I mean, was the did it do that? Did it sort of, was there one point where you decided you were going to get out of the pool and start
running? I evolved to a land creature.
It did sound a bit like that, didn't it? I apologize.
So yeah, growing up, I suppose, as a swimmer, I just inherently hated running. I can still remember the odd time, and it was very occasional, that we had to do a mile run in high school or, you know, for practice, and I just disdained it. And I was probably not half bad at it because I was fit, but I just didn't enjoy it. It felt a lot like hard work. And I think to a great extent, running does still feel unnatural to me. And maybe that's part of the appeal to me, is that in and of itself, it's a challenge for me. It doesn't come naturally. So the evolution from swimming to running for me started with, I guess, just that. It was the draw, the appeal of something that was going to be truly a challenge, that wasn't going to come easy to me. And it, I suppose, happened when I was living in New York City. I was doing my master's degrees there and decided, as you do, that a bucket list thing was going to be to run a marathon. And what better time to do it than when I was living in New York and to be able to run the iconic New York City Marathon. So I trained for that. Again, that was, you know, a challenge in and of itself, and ran that marathon, ticked that box, and thought, well, that was nice, and I'm never doing that again. And then it wasn't really until my partner and I moved to Scotland, and in fact, several years after we moved to Scotland, when I was introduced to trail running. And I guess suddenly for me, there was this marrying of, you know, I've always been sporty. And I guess that's what swimming gave me, was a base of fitness to my mental and my physical health from doing a sport. And I guess I kind of matured to be able to recognize that didn't need to be swimming, but that I needed to be active to maintain kind of my mental and physical health. And at the same time, then the trail running just kind of opened my eyes to a whole community of individuals, of trails.
How did that happen?
as many of these things do, it was someone telling me something that I didn't believe could possibly be a thing. So in this case, it was the West Highland Way, which is the 95-mile trail from Milngavie to Fort William in Scotland. And it was, so I do have a background in climbing and mountaineering, and my partner and I had been, I think, on a climbing trip or hiking trip, something in kind of the Highlands. And as we were driving home toward Glasgow, he made some reference to knowing someone who once had run the West Highland Way in one go. And I said, that's not a thing. Nobody does that. That is just not a thing. You're telling a tale. And this is kind of before your days at Google. So I went home and I don't know what I did. I found some forum, or I think Facebook was in existence then. And lo and behold, there were these people who did this completely unbelievable thing of running 95 miles pretty much nonstop. And I just thought that that was awesome in the true sense of the word. These lunatics had an organized kind of group training run arranged for shortly thereafter. It was an out and back run. So for me, there was a bit of security in that I could start this group run. And if, you know, when I was a broken human, I could turn around and go back to my car with my tail between my legs.
That would take an awful lot of confidence to have the nerve to go out and just say, hi, can I join your really ultra elite runners almost? Can I join your little group? Wow.
Yeah, I think actually it reflects that the ultra running community, in my experience, and it started from that very, very, you know, day one of being even exposed to this forum of West Highland Way Runners, was this sense of community and this sense of welcoming and openness and inclusion. And I think I was really drawn to that. And I think the fact that that first run for me, I mean, don't get me wrong, I didn't sleep the night before. And I love my sleep. I couldn't eat because I was nauseous with anxiety about joining this group. I remember getting a lift from someone else who I didn't know, so that we were car sharing from Glasgow to wherever the running was starting. And I remember her talking about runs she had done, and they were completely unfamiliar to me. Most of them probably still would be. And I was just, I can't even imagine being that anxious again, joining a group. But I did, and I got there, and I had decided, you know, right, even if I go a mile and I turn around and I go back to the car, and of course the run was starting and finishing in a pub, so worst case scenario, I do a little outing on my own and, you know, treat myself to a nice pub meal afterwards for my bravery. Lo and behold, they were incredibly welcoming and inclusive and supportive, and that is a feeling that I get from that community generally, that people are there to obviously be competitive amongst themselves, but also to really support people in their individual pursuits. And I got that impression from the very first second that I met them. And in fact, it's very relevant then to the Monroe round, because the person who welcomed me on that first run was a gentleman named John Kinniston, who sadly has since passed away. But it was actually listening to John interview Donnie about his Monroe round that inspired me to even consider doing the Monroe round myself. So it did come absolutely full circle from that first West Highland Way run.
You're very generous in talking of other people and of the community, but how were you when you ran it? Was it a surprise that it was, hang on a second, I'm good at this?
I think it was a hang on a second. I don't have to be the fastest. I just have to be able to keep going. And I suppose I do think swimming definitely gave me a baseline fitness and a baseline of endurance that I probably didn't appreciate that I had until it was, I guess, tested with longer distance running. So I think for me, it was this aha moment of actually, I don't need to be able to run a fast park run or this actually can be quite enjoyable. And for me, it became quite social in that the pace we were going and the pace I needed to sustain was a pace that was chatty. So kind of this sense that if I was going too fast that I couldn't chat, I was going too fast. Or if I was going so fast that I couldn't chat, that was too fast. So it kind of was inherently then a social experience as well as a physical one. So it combines the fitness, it combines my love of being outside. And I think swimming for me, I probably transitioned away from swimming when I went to uni in Chicago, because suddenly all the pools were indoors. And I think it's maybe hard to understand for people who have never been swimming outdoors regularly in a pool. But I think for me, even though it's the same lap, it's the same distance pool and it's the same in your own headspace, I definitely missed swimming in an outdoor pool, first in Chicago and then coming to Scotland. So I think for me, getting some outside time with like-minded people, doing an activity that suddenly was quite enjoyable, it didn't just feel like a chore, for the sake of fitness and for the sake that it was reasonably inexpensive, which is why I did it to begin with. I wanted to be fitter, but I didn't have much money, and running seemed good for that. But yeah, actually, I wasn't bad at it, and I seem to be better if the distance is even longer.
She's not kidding. Let's review some of Jamie's achievements before she started the Munro record attempt. She'd already done two Munro rounds, completed the West Highland Way 95-mile race three times, including having an all-time top 10 female record. She held the female record for the Caterham Trail Ultra, a two-times winner of the Ultra Trail Snowdonia, that's a 100-miler, first female in the inaugural Maxi Madeira 100K, first female in the inaugural O'Hills Ultra 50-miler. She'd done a Bob Graham round, a Ramsey round, some adventure racing, the Strathpuffer 24-hour mountain bike race. You get the idea. But it was listening to Donnie Campbell talk about his round that sparked the idea of her attempt.
Yes, I think actually the true moment, if I'm being perfectly honest, was listening to him in an interview, I think with John, when he made reference, he was asked a question about his recovery during the round itself, and he made reference to kind of prioritizing sleep to aid his recovery, which is absolutely sensible. And he estimated that he had averaged 8 hours of sleep a night. And I just remember thinking, so I know I'm not as fast on the move as Donnie or many other people, but I can certainly do sleep deprivation a lot better than that. And I kind of planted that little seed away. The only person I mentioned about it originally was John Kinniston, actually, who in that very supportive way sent me a message that just said, you should go for this.
Because this is a superpower of micro naps you have.
It is. I think sleep deprivation in general and micro naps in particular. And that seed that was planted in listening to Donnie, and it wasn't just about the sleep, it was also about this absolutely inspirational thing that he had done. And I had done two rounds of Munros prior to hearing that interview, where I was nearing the completion, I guess, of my second one, which I did with my rescue dogs. But So I was familiar with the Munros. I was familiar with the concept. I was familiar with, you know, I certainly don't think I was underestimating by any means what he had achieved. And I think for that reason, I was quite intimidated by the idea and I kind of put it to one side. And it was months and months later that I realized I was still thinking about it. And that for me is always a bad sign that I'm still stewing on it. It must mean that gauntlet's been thrown and I need to do something about it.
I do think these things find you more than you choosing
yes.
them. So you've said in the interviews that I've read that initially this wasn't a record attempt, but I just listening to you there, I get the feeling it probably was, but you weren't publicly voicing that. Is that fair?
It probably is, yeah. Yeah, I think also I wasn't publicly voicing it, and there's probably a part of me that subconsciously didn't want to accept that either, because that
because then you could have had a failure.
Overwhelming. Yeah, yeah. I think, and also it's funny you use that word, because for me, I've never been scared of failure. I've always found failure, you know, it's the carrot in a way. It's kind of that thing you hold in your back pocket that if you weren't anxious about failure, then it's probably not a scary enough challenge or a big enough challenge that would really appeal to me. So I think that element of it might not happen, I might not be successful is something that, you know, I do find drives me. I think the difference with the Munro rounds was that in order to get fundraising that I wanted, in order to get bits and pieces of sponsorship that I was, you know, really welcoming, I needed to be out in the public domain. And that for me was where the fear of failure really, yeah, where I really experienced it for the first time. Putting myself out there was quite scary.
Obviously, you have to be ridiculously fit or you don't even get out the door. That's the ticket for playing in this game. That's your entry fee, as it were. And you can't really train for the repetitive nature of what you're going to be doing. You can't train your recovery. So I've read that you said you trained for resilience, and I'm not sure what you mean by that. Could you explain it?
I guess I mean that I'm not sure about training for the resilience as much as having built up the resilience and having the memories of times that I needed to be self-sufficient, times that, and I'm thinking not so much about running and more about mountaineering and, you know, situations that were still of my choosing that I ended up in, but actually consequences potentially quite high. To dig deep to get yourself out of, you know, I don't know, some kind of climb. I had, you know, 10, 15 years of self-reliance, self-sufficiency, tenacity that doesn't leave you. And even if it's in a different context, in the fact that I was, you know, doing a big hike with cycling in between, I think my confidence that I could even take it on came from the fact that I had this 10 to 15 years of proving to myself that I was resilient, of, you know, being able to pick myself up when I was down, of, you know, recovering from injuries, of keeping going when, you know, keeping going felt like the last thing on earth might have wanted to do in a race or in training. So I definitely, you know, I've built up a couple of mantras over the years that probably support that mentality. So one certainly that I think is most applicable probably to your question, I will say to myself when times are really, really bad, would I quit if I was winning? And if the answer is no, keep going. So I think for me, that's just the kind of sums up that, yeah, that resilient mentality.
Interesting. I wasn't sure whether resilience was going to be mental or physical that we're going to come out with. Clearly mental. But on the physical side of things, did you have a recovery regime? I mean, did somebody massage your legs when you finished every day?
No, should have asked for that. It wasn't time for that. I did have a couple of friends who massaged my feet, particularly my left foot, a couple of times when it was at its worst. So yeah, kudos to them for braving touching my feet. I helped to maintain, maybe even prevent injury as well as aid recovery. So making sure that I had a good balance of protein and carbs. I'm a quite strict vegetarian. So I was incredibly fortunate that two of my friends prior to the round had batch cooked just a ton of really high quality, nutritious veggie food for me. So I was, you know, drinking protein shakes and eating well. I certainly wasn't sleeping well. So I needed to sort of counterbalance that with other forms of recovery when I could. But yeah, I don't think I had a particularly recovery routine, in that I didn't really have a routine. It was move when I can, sleep when I need to kind of mentality, and definitely loved my sleep whenever I had the chance to take it. My kind of very rough schedule that I'd set when I started was to get 6 hours of sleep a night. And even that I thought was going to be pushing it. And I was worried about my recovery overnight. When I started the round on the 26th of May was when Scotland then entered, I think it was the highest temperature Scotland had seen in years or ever for that time of year. We had a 2 week hot streak that really, really challenged both my pace. It made it quite difficult because burns were dry that would typically have had water that we could have accessed. So we were probably all a bit dehydrated for the first couple of weeks. And it was impacting the pace I could go during the day. So I actually started to cut my sleep overnight quite early on to see if there was any merit in moving more through the night and sleeping a bit through the day. And then I just completely threw any semblance of sleep routine that I had hoped to have went right out the window in that sort of first week to 10 days.
It's interesting that you said we. You really did have a whole team behind you, and people were taking their turns running with you, yeah?
They were. It was awesome. And that had been, so this was 2 years in the planning. It started, as I said, with that first kind of mentioned to John Kinniston, and then told Andy, my partner, and my friend Jenny Allen, who became my right-hand woman and project manager. So she and I had created it was basically like a scoping survey of people who might be interested in support. And we'd sent that out into the social media ether on Facebook to see who, if anyone, might be interested in, you know, coming along, not necessarily just to join me on the Hill, but at that point, I didn't know how much time off Andy was going to take. So, you know, there was the potential we needed people to help drive the van, to deliver my bike to weird and wonderful places, to assist with car shuttles for people who had been on the Hill with me, that sort of thing. So there were lots of options for people who wanted to get involved, even if they weren't, for whatever reason, able or wanting to join me on the Hill or indeed on the bike. So that survey garnered over 100 responses. And I think well over a third of that response rate was from people who I had never met, complete and utter strangers who had reached out and said, "This sounds really cool. I'd like to be involved. How can I help?" And that just created this logistics nightmare, but an incredible community of support that I was fortunate to have.
Because this is an adventure racing skill almost, in that you are trying to get a bike delivered to the place you need it when you come off that hill, so you can jump on it and ride to your next hill, and likewise a kayak if you're going to cross a loch. So I just imagine the logistics from that must be, I mean, A, you clearly need a good team just to get those in the right place. I mean, done a little bit of adventure racing because it can easily go wrong. But you also need someone who can organize those logistics.
Yeah, Jenny deserves an OB or whatever. People who are exceptionally good at logistics should get. Our spreadsheet that we made is beautiful. If you like a spreadsheet, it's a beautiful spreadsheet. And yeah, it was... it was detailed to the nth degree. And I suppose before I started, the goal was to, I suppose, control as many variables and to plan for as many variables as we possibly could, knowing that there were going to be a million and one things completely out of my control once we started. So the preparation was very much about, what can we organize? What can this spreadsheet and the information that we're providing to other people, what can that include that will be most helpful and make things most straightforward once I'm on the go? And of course, inevitably, things change almost instantly. And Jenny and then a whole troop of friends who came to the fore, but especially Jenny and Andy, were there making amendments to the spreadsheet. There was a WhatsApp group that grew into several hundred, I think, separate little WhatsApp groups, and people were coordinating behind the scenes, and I just needed to keep going. So actually, once we started, in a way, I had the easy job, I think. I just needed to be wound up and pushed in the right direction.
Let's talk some of the other issues. You've talked about the heat, so let's talk sunburn, foot blisters, and midges. I don't know if they have ever been lumped together in one particular file like that. Take it away.
The trinity of hell. Sounds
a bit... Oh, you're a bit early for midges, hopefully. I don't know. But let's start with the sunburn.
The sunburn, yes. Who would have thought that May, early June... California girl doing an outing in Scotland, that sunburn was going to be one of my biggest setbacks. But yet it was. So we were completely, I shouldn't say unprepared, we had sunscreen. I was just completely unprepared for how sunny and for how long of each day it was going to be. And I ended up getting incredibly bad blisters sort of on the inside of my lower lip, to the extent that Andy and I think others were, we had a medical physio WhatsApp group in the background. So Andy was seeking advice from a couple of doctors in that group, chemists. In fact, the chemist in Killearn, I think, gave me a prescription for something for these burns on my lips. They were probably just shy of needing actual medical intervention, as in I may have needed to get pulled because they were pretty horrible. So that was pretty awful. And
how do you get sunburn inside your lips? I mean, what
yeah,
are you doing?
You're not the first to ask. I don't think I'd run with a powdered lip either. I think it's just that, and I was wearing a baseball cap or a visor all of the time. I think it's just that, I obviously had my mouth open 18 hours a day, sun beating down. It was just sort of right inside my inner lip. it wasn't just chapped lips. It was distinct, kind of quite severe burns. And the problem then was that the little sleep that I was getting, at that point, I was still getting kind of 5+ hours of sleep a night. And I had medicine to put on them overnight, kind of specialist chapsticky stuff. And I would sleep and they would begin to heal. This is really grim. Apologies to your listeners. I'd begin to heal overnight. But basically what was happening is that my lips were almost healing by scabbing together. So every morning for about 4 or 5 days in a row, when I'd open my mouth to breathe after sleeping, I basically was ending up with a bloody mouth every morning. It was horrendous. Yeah, it was really, really classy. It was a very classy month I had. But they did eventually heal.
The foot blisters were unexpected because you'd run long distances previously.
Yeah, I think so. I got one blister on the outside heel of each foot. And I blame contouring. I blame contouring for a lot of things, but I really blame contouring for those. And I was very fortunate that I actually ended up basically going down a half size in shoe. So I had been fortunate. I'd been given some Saucony shoes in my size. I've always run in Sauconys, decided I would, you know, continue in them, always loved them. And yeah, I think just that tiny bit of extra movement in my shoe, I ended up going down a half size. And luckily someone was able to, so yeah, the van, I think I had half a dozen pairs of size 9s, which is my usual shoe size, which is again, huge for a girl who's 5'6".
There's your flippers.
Yeah, they were all pretty useless because it was an 8.5 that I needed. So Jenny again organized to get me some smaller shoes, but unfortunately the damage at that point was done. And I think, you know, again, I was on my feet for 17, 18 hours a day. So probably inevitable. But then they both ended up quite severely infected. So luckily there was a doctor friend who had joined the merry band of Jamie's Monroe Challenge crew, who at one point when I was in the Fisher Fields, so very much toward the end of the round, probably day 28, 29, my feet were in excruciating pain. I was just in horrible pain, barely able to walk the length of myself. And my friend Nick ended up driving through the night with her 6-year-old in the car to meet me in Dundonald at the foot of Anchalach so that she could deal with my, what we then discovered were infected blisters. So, yeah, gratitude to her for sure.
You've got some good friends.
They were amazing. And in fairness, I didn't know Nick before we started. So not only was she someone who came out of the woodwork, but she then was willing to drive through the night to touch my feet and scalpels were involved. It was grim.
And I guess it's probably worse. The midges would be worse for those people waiting for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think they downplayed probably how much torture they were going through waiting for me because they knew that I was going as fast as I could. And I think as crew, you never want to miss or be late for the person you're supporting. So inevitably they would be early and I would be slower than expected. So they probably ended up, you know, waiting in midge fests for, you know, double the time. Quite impressive. There was a lot of bug spray going around. My worst experience of the midges was in kind of Tindrum area when in a very rare set of circumstances, it was really hot. It was about 9 in the morning, going up quite a challenging hill, completely off-piste, so kind of heather bashing, quite steep. It was very hot. I was very tired and the midges were just horrendous. And this was on going up a Monroe 9-10 in the morning. And I just went a little bit bananas and I was with, again, someone I'd only met the morning of, poor girl. And I just lost my stuff. I was screaming. I was swearing. I dumped my remaining water all over myself to get them to stay away. So then of course I was without water. And I think the midges just licked it up and then came back for more. So that was by far my worst experience. And I find the midges will, if I ever move from Scotland, it's not going to be because of the weather. It's going to be because the midges drove me away.
They remind us of our place on the food chain. That's the only good thing I can think. I was struck when I started reading Fiona Outdoors' website by comparing the statistics between your round and Donnie Campbell's round in terms of distances. I'm sure you've done this, but you ran 107 kilometers less. You cycled 194 kilometers less. You climbed 5,020 meters less. And while he did two kayak sections, you did five. So your route, I would say, was significantly shorter to run, shorter cycle, less elevation gain. I'm wondering how significant you think that was in you getting this record by these all-important 13 hours, and also how you came up with it, because it must have been a brilliant route for those who want to do this sort of thing.
Yeah, I'll sell it to the highest bidder. So I think Donnie did, I think there's maybe a few misquotes in there. I think he did three kayak sections. He and I both crossed from Mull to the mainland. We both did an out and back on Loch Lomond, and we both crossed over to Skye.
Okay.
I love kayaking. I actually think perhaps I chose the wrong challenge, and every time I got in the boat, I just was in my, it was just bliss.
No midges.
Perhaps next thing should be. Exactly. And in fact, there were several times where the midges were horrendous on the shore, and it was just for their motivation to make that transition incredibly slick to get out on the water as quickly as possible. So, yeah, I think maybe next challenge will be a water-based activity. Get back to my swimming roots. We spent 2 years scrutinizing maps to within an inch of their life to try and identify. Basically, I think the key difference in our routes, or perhaps in our route planning, was that, and I haven't spoken to Donnie about this, so I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think his route clearly started and finished at night at the road so that he could have a good night's sleep in his camper van. I took the element of roads basically out, or needing to cross a road or be in a vehicle. I took that element out of my route planning and said, right, what's the most efficient route we can come up with? And I will camp, I will bivvy when I can be in the van, excellent, but I want to plan a route that isn't contingent on me only sleeping in the vehicle or in, you know, some kind of accommodation. And I think for me, that was from, you know, again, a background in kind of camping, mountaineering. I have no problem sleeping in a tent or bivvying. The key difference is the extra weight you have to carry. So we definitely had time where some of the logistics was about, you know, and some of the route planning absolutely was about, is there an option for someone to hike in or cycle in with camping equipment so that I can still be traveling light, but I don't need to be accessible to a road when I need to sleep. So again, that was part of the kind of logistics of the 2 years of planning, was working out where are those camping opportunities that don't require me to carry full camping gear, but enable me to be on the most efficient route as possible. So I think that was definitely a key difference. And I'm not sure, I think some of those stats I probably need to revisit now that they've come off my watch and various other things. But yeah, it's not far off though. I mean, when we were planning it, we estimated that I was going to do about 200K less cycling than Donnie. So what you've just quoted is very close to that. And yeah, I think it was about 100, it was 100 some K less. No, I think it was 80 some K less hiking. And in fairness, some of my, what may have been marked as hiking, what may have been marked as cycling, there were a few route choices that I hadn't had time to recce that I thought I was going to be able to bike. And instead I took my bike for a walk. So I don't know if you count that as a bike or a hike, but, it was the worst of both worlds, basically. So there were a few route choices, but I would definitely change if I were to do it again, which I'm not.
But I do wonder if that's going to become, you know, the way you do this, because these routes do get handed down.
Yeah, quite possibly. I think it depends, again, you know, on the team around the folks, or how strong or willing someone feels to carry their gear. I mean, at one point Andy kayaked in with our friend Lorraine to set up a camp in Mullerdoch kind of area. So, you know, it was also the fact that I had folks who were willing to, you know, go on this silly adventure with me and meet me in absolutely crazy places, being, as you say, eaten alive by midges to set up a camp for me in the middle of the night. So, or food drops, water drops, that kind of thing as well, particularly because of the heat. So we were fortunate to pull all of that together. But in the planning, you know, Jenny and I had big maps that I'd had printed out, that my friend Joe, who's a mapper, had hung around. I have a little Lego Jamie, and we had little game board pieces that we would move around the map, basically working out my route with the spreadsheet, to make sure that our logistics, that we weren't accidentally leaving someone stranded at the end of a leg, that we hadn't accidentally abandoned a kayak somewhere that we couldn't get back to, that we hadn't put a bike somewhere that, you know, wasn't actually where I was going to be. All of those things we kind of modeled in advance. And yeah, so it certainly didn't happen overnight, getting a route that was as efficient as we managed to make it.
For a runner, slightly curious, you're raising money for World Bicycle Relief. Have you done okay with that?
Yes, we have. I think getting the record and getting the media attention that we did after the round certainly boosted our fundraising exponentially. So I was just looking at it before we joined the call there, that I think with gift aid, we're approaching £27,000 for World Bicycle Relief, which is just amazing. Yeah,
And this is for these Buffalo bikes. Have you experience of how they've helped people in the developing world?
Not firsthand, but certainly one of my ambitions will be to get to see them in action. I think that would just be awesome. And actually, my new ambitious goal is to raise as much money. So basically to raise per bike. So if we could get the fundraising to a Buffalo bike for every Monroe, so 120 times 282, that would just be awesome.
How much
World Bicycle Relief. I'll get my calculator out.
Okay. Never mind. You'll get there. That'll be next on your phone. There'll be a link to your Just Giving page in the show notes for this.
Amazing.
Look, finally, let me just ask you this. It sounds as if I know the answer to this, but have the bad moments faded and the good moments really solidified in your mind now?
At the risk of sounding sadistic, I actually want to replay both the good moments and the bad moments in my head still, because I haven't given myself an opportunity to properly write down and kind of reflect on what was almost now a sleep deprived blur of a month. And I do have a worry that, you know, in a couple of weeks, a couple of months, certainly in a couple of years, I'll look back and think, oh, there was this thing that we did and it was really quite cool at the time, and I just have no memory of it whatsoever. So I'd actually, my intention is to take some time out, and for no one other than myself, just to take some notes on each day and try and conjure up what those bad moments were like, because I think they are really important to reflect upon and build on and learn from, as much as, you know, absolutely I want to remember some of the funny things that happened while we were out. And I've been fortunate. I wrote to our WhatsApp group, refuses to die. So there's still 100 of us in a group together. I had kind of reached out to folks and asked them to send me their memories of, and their reflections and their highs and their lows. And I've had about a dozen folks come back, and it's just been so fun to hear things from their perspective, to hear some things that were happening behind the scenes that I was absolutely none the wiser was happening. And to be reminded of, actually, you know, we shared some laughs, we had some really good times. I don't want to forget that. And I don't want it to become something that was just about a record, because it's not. It was so much more than that. And to share this adventure with, you know, literally friends, new and old, people who I met, you know, as we were setting off from the van in the morning, or meeting people in the middle of the night who had hiked out to see me, kind of thing. I don't want all of that to be reduced to just a record, because actually I do think there's something far more meaningful here than that. And that's what I want to hang on to. So the plan is to do some writing and reflect on the good and the bad, and then try and repress all the bad memories.
Which is pretty much the definition of type 2 fun. My massive thanks to Jamie Ahrens for taking the time to record that. Her Just Giving page is listed in the show notes. It's along with a link to buy me a small virtual coffee. It's just a way I can help keep these podcasts advert-free and still pay for the monthly hosting costs. You can also find links at alwaysanotheradventure.com. I'm Simon Willis. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.